Score, the podcast. The only show taking you inside the studios of the world's most celebrated composers and musicians.
Let's roll.
Are we rocking and rolling?
I'm Kenny Holmes. That's Robert Kraft. That's Matt Schrader. This is Score the Podcast. And we've been off for a few weeks, but we're excited about our guest today. Really excited. This is kind of a long time coming. During the pandemic, and we'll get into this a little bit with our guest today, Rudy Mancuso. Rudy reached out to us. He's a superstar, TikTok, YouTube. He's a musical genius, and he was really wanting to get into the space of scoring a big film. Not only has he done that, he's starring in it, he wrote it, he directed it, and he scored it. So he kind of manifested this, and months, you know, years ago, he reached out to us saying, like, hey, I love what you guys are doing. It'd be great to collab. And now we have him on the show, which is really cool. So
you've just provided me with another answer to the question that I was actually asked yesterday for the 1,000,000th time. You know, what can I do to get more involved in film scoring and to how do I network? And, you know, it's a legitimate question because it's a very hard arena. And like anything, it's luck and skill. I never have thought that option four is write, produce, and star in your own movie and then score it.
Right.
That's like, of course, you know, you want to get the film scoring, create your own product, and then write the music. Done.
Just so everybody knows too, the film is called Musica, and it's out on Prime today, had a big splash at South By, and I think it's interesting. It's about synesthesia, this whole kind of concept of seeing, you know, experiencing, I should say, rhythm and tonality and all these different kind of weird notes,
color,
and different kind of things. Robert, I think you have a version of that when it comes to certain musical things that you see, or I forget what it is. Is it colors?
Not necessarily colors. I mean, I wish I could tell you it was that exotic. My version when I hear that is certain chord patterns actually bring this kind of emotional memory moment for me that I spend the next minute. I'm dangerous when it happens when I'm driving and listening to music, because I'm then, that was like sixth grade. I first heard those. What is that that makes me feel a certain way? Whoa, wait,
oh,
I'm going to crash.
Yeah, God forbid you're trying to merge right then.
Right.
Well, and this movie is a bit of a biopic too. I think it's loosely based, but it features his own mom. The love interest is now his girlfriend, and they're like this power couple in Hollywood. It's pretty cool.
You know what?
All of this is happening.
I think you actually just articulated another option that Rudy has opened up to all of us, which is if you want to meet a girl, write a movie, produce it, star in it, cast her. It's
there you go.
These are really, you know, why send a Tinder swipe to somebody? Say, I have a multi-million dollar project I'd like to cast you in. It, by the way, it's not as uncommon as you would think.
I imagine, yeah. Now, the other thing going on now or about now, it's now as we're recording this, it's National Film Score Day. So as for everyone listening to this on April 4th, the day that this is releasing,
1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3.
We're in the past. We're one day in the past. National Film Score Day started just a few years ago. It was after our film released. It was the year after that, actually. And it's kind of odd that April 3rd is the date, because that is when The Jungle Book premiered in the 40s, I think 1943, something like that. And Miklos Rocha did the score for that. And that was considered, you know, a year after that, that was the first soundtrack that was released, orchestral, kind of the traditional film score that we think of just for listening purposes. So that was kind of, that's what National Film Score Day commemorates, is that particular moment, which I've never really thought of as being the biggest moment for film scores, but cool little piece of trivia at the very least.
There's also another notable April 3rd, 2018, a huge day in the film music world, was when we announced that we were making this show publicly.
That's why it's National Film Score Day. Come on, we have to rewrite the history.
Boom.
That's it. Score makes an announcement.
And TV scores. I do want to give a shout out. One of our awesome listeners and a great composer. She's skyrocketing up the ranks. Her name is Chanel Critchlow. She scored the March Madness theme for the women's tournament, ESPN. I know a lot of people have been watching the women's tournament this year. There's a lot of buzz with Caitlin Clark and all this if you're a sports fan. But shout out to Chanel. The theme rocks. And if, you know, when you watch March basketball, that theme is hitting you every 3 minutes when they go to commercial break. So hopefully she's getting a lot of love on that. And we're thankful that you listen. And shout out to Chanel. She's
very cool. Message
that's fantastic. That, so. I do think the National Film Score Day, I'm just going to say this for all the musicians in the audience, can we lobby to make it, instead of the date April 3rd, which is 4-3,
we should make 4-4.
Come on.
Dude.
Why isn't National Film Score Day 4-4, which is, I mean, you know, we could have it 3-4.
Let's go ahead and drop this episode on 4-4. We'll do our part. That's what we'll do to commemorate one day after National Film Score Day. See, this
was
all planned.
How about we make 4-4 National Score the Podcast Day?
There it is.
Problem solved.
All right.
I don't think we have the authority to change National Score Day, but National Score the Podcast Day, definitely 4-4. well, we got Rudy Mancuso coming up. A lot to talk about with the synesthesia, his artist career on YouTube, and how to kind of navigate that. We'll get into that a little bit for a lot of you guys who are trying to market yourselves. What are the things to take away from that? If he has any tips for you. And also, go watch Musica on Prime Video. It's out today. We're not going to spoil anything in this interview, but we do talk about it a little bit. So if you want to watch the film first and then listen to this, it might make a lot more sense.
It's pretty cool. You'll like it.
Let's get to it. We're going to get to our interview now with our guest, Rudy Mancuso.
The last thing you want to hear when you need your auto insurance most is,
thank you for calling. Please listen to your list of 46 possible service options.
Which is why when you choose USAA auto insurance, you'll get great service that is easy and reliable. 24/7 online service for claims, access to roadside assistance, and more. All at the touch of a button. Start getting the service you deserve. Get a quote today. USAA. Ability to receive a quote depends on membership eligibility. Membership eligibility and product restrictions apply and are subject to change. USAA means United Services Automobile Association and its affiliates, San Antonio, Texas.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
First off, I'm going to say it's a guarantee you've seen one of his videos at least across social media over
sure.
the last decade,
yeah.
Mainly because he's racked up more than 25 million followers and more than a billion views across all platforms. He's also the director, star, co-writer, and composer of a brand new movie out today on Prime Video called Musica. Please welcome Rudy Mancuso to the show. What's up, Rudy?
What's up? What's going on, guys? Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. So we connected on Instagram. I looked back at the timestamp. It was like April, right into the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And you sent our score page a message saying, thanks for the inspiration. Would love to join forces and help each other celebrate the fascinating process of our beloved composers. Now we're here talking about your movie, which you scored. So
you're welcome
kind of
for
manifested
the inspiration,
this.
By the way.
Yeah. Thank you so much. It was all you, Matt.
It was a combination, you know, we both did it together, basically.
Yeah.
We didn't see our name in the credits of music.
Yeah,
though.
Where was
the part there? What's going on?
Oh, it's a very, very, very end of the end scroll. Anyway. But yeah, I remember sending that message because also inspired by the documentary and the fact that there was another community of people who were showing love for a position and role in filmmaking that I've been obsessed with for as long as I've been obsessed with film itself, which is film composing and film composition. And you highlighted the best of the best in the doc. And it was around a time, I discovered that around the time that I was doing my own like online series and interviews with composers. I had like an Instagram live session with Michael Giacchino and Rachel Portman and Benjamin Wallfish, John Debney, etc. Hence why I sent the message.
That's very cool. And after watching your movie, first off, for those who haven't seen it yet, it comes out today when this episode drops. But first off, thank you for making something unique. And, you know, it's not in front of a green screen the whole movie. It was just really refreshing to see something creative and new. And it was kind of like La La Land that didn't take itself too seriously with puppets involved too. I don't know. That was the vibe I got. Maybe an East Coast La La Land. But what was the backstory of this, and how long was this brewing for you?
Well, I suppose that's the thing, because of the autobiographical nature, it's I could safely say it's been brewing for as long as I could remember. The minute I started creating and playing music and making my own film stories, I fantasized about one day making a film loosely based off of my experience that highlighted Brazilian culture, that highlighted the Ironbound in Newark, and that highlighted, most importantly, this perspective of synesthesia, the synesthetic perspective that I've had, and it's very real. So it wasn't like a light bulb moment. It was more so just like I knew I wanted to make a film. I knew I wanted to be autobiographical for maybe 15 years. And then I started actualizing that fantasy about 7 to 8 years ago. And then we got the film sold about 5 years ago.
Wow. So this was pre-pandemic. You had did that set it back a little bit, do you think?
Yeah, definitely. That definitely complicated the process a bit, but I had shot a sizzle on my own. The sizzle was kind of like a poor man's version of the opening scene of the film, where Rudy sits with Haley, his current girlfriend, and the diner sounds start to intrude in the conversation. I shot almost a short film version of that on my own and used that as the pitch. And that's part of what got everyone excited, including Amazon. But yes, the pandemic definitely put a dent in the development process.
What was one of the things that we've touched on a few times, and Kenny, I know this is something you and I've talked about, is this synesthesia, and a lot of people have kind of different versions of that. Some composers we've talked to feel like they kind of paint with colors mm-hmm. with synesthesia. Some people see words or kind of, you know, identify unique feelings about it. A lot of composers obviously associate feelings with certain notes and certain, you know, things like that. But I know this film is so so much of the musicality of even the score is kind of injected into parts of this film and the storytelling itself. The Rudy character, we'll talk about Rudy in third person sort of here. Is that representative of how you actually, is it rhythm that you primarily hear? Is that kind of the biggest association you have when we talk about synesthesia?
I would say so. Yes, I tried in the film to capture the essence of what that experience is really like as much as possible. Of course, in a much more grandiose, romantic, light way. But yeah, it's always started with rhythm. Trying to find the rhythm in situations where there isn't any, which I guess is kind of a controversial thing to say, because technically, there's rhythm in music in everything, in anything. You could mm-hmm. find and make a rhythm out of everything. But I was always trying to organize it into a more palatable rhythm, everyday regular sounds for as long as I could remember. I remember, you know, being a kid and not being able to sustain my attention in class or in school because my focus was entirely on somebody tapping their pencil. Or the footsteps of the principal walking the hallways, or a big one was the chalk on the chalkboard, and I desperately in my head was like, there's got to be a way I can turn that into like a 3-4 or a 4-4 or 6-8, depending on how they were doing it. And sometimes they would do it without even realizing. They'd have like a and I was like, you guys fucking hearing this? Is no one else hearing this? Yeah. And then by the end of class, I didn't hear a single thing that the teacher actually said, because I was so hyper focused on those things. So it's very real. This isn't just a storytelling device. It's unfortunately very real, because it's not always fun. It very much can hinder my one's experience and also get in the way of their relationships.
I would imagine. Hold on. Before we move forward, did it force you into music, or were you in music and then you discovered this?
It's a good question. I definitely fell in love with music and was exploring music before I could even like speak. I think I was very young and was very attracted to the piano. And then I think when I was about 5, my mother said I just walked over to the piano and started playing, playing by ear and emulating all the melodies that I would hear. I would play back on the piano. So music was a passion, I'd say first, and then I started to discover this condition as I got a little bit older.
Now, go ahead, Matt. This film came together. There's only a few films that we can think of, and you know, we are constantly analyzing films for their score, their musical content. This is one of those films that it really got me thinking in the middle of this. How did this all come together? But beyond that, this is probably the best example that I can think of a film that where really the director and the composer are one person, had to be like simpatico on everything for this to work. So I'm curious about kind of the process of how this came together. What were the first steps? How much of the music, kind of came before you shot something, or were those evolving at the same time? Because I'm sure that same rhythm, you were starting to notice that probably when you were seeing, you know, the dailies come in or whatever it might be, and the edits start to come together, and you probably start to feel a little bit of the rhythm going on and how the cuts were coming together and the spotting. But tell me about how the music evolved with the picture.
In this case, it was a bit reverse engineered. I wrote the music and had demos for every set piece before we even wrote the script. I had the pieces in mind already. I had more or less the style, the rhythms, the tempos, and the musical kind of motifs and ideas before the story was even fully beat out. So that by the time there was a script, and by the time we were actually in prep, none of that was being left to chance. Because, you know, typically you're shooting your film with your dialogue and you're recording live sound on the day. And unless it's a musical, all things music and composition come afterwards. And a lot of times it's case by case, but a lot of times the composer's composing during the development process. Sometimes they're composing as they're receiving dailies, but they're not actually putting music to picture until later. We kind of did it the other way around. We composed before cameras were rolling. And every set piece in the film that you heard was recorded live. So nothing was pre-recorded. Nothing was overdubbed. Some things were accentuated. That's so cool. But, and of course, when you hear stuff like strings and a piano melody or underscore, that was recorded later. But all of the big set pieces where the rhythm performers are turning objects into music, all that was recorded live. At one point we had, like the diner setup, we had like 99 mics. There's a microphone on everything from the broom to the sink to the microwave to the stove.
Wow.
And we got, there was a lot of pushback because you had the camera crew. Shane, my DP, was like, why on earth are you spending 2 hours to set up microphones which could very easily be done in post, whereas a camera setup can't. And we said, because that's how we want to do it.
Well, it's apparent when you watch it, you know, because we talk a lot about this too, when actors don't play a piano and then they're on screen playing a piano and it obviously doesn't match.
Drives
up,
me crazy.
Lip syncing. But this, the all of these scenes, everything felt so authentic. And now it makes total sense that you actually recorded it on set.
We recorded all of 95% of all the sounds in the musical set pieces were recorded live. Yeah.
One of the cool things then this is a leading question a little bit, the mixing of a lot of these musical pieces. I noticed the mix, and we are hearing it in stereo, so it's even then is a little bit limited, but the mix of this, there's a lot of left and right happening, putting us kind of in the center of the music, which mm-hmm. is not typically something we see in scores. Mm-hmm. It's not even really something you typically see in songs in movies. But here, because of the rhythm and so much kind of percussion, I felt like I was in the very middle of this experience. That, I'm sure, was a conscious decision.
Yeah, it was done deliberately. I wanted as much as possible for the viewer to feel as though, like you said, they were very much in the middle and immersed into the music rather than music just being backdrop or underscore. I wanted it to feel like the viewer was in the middle of it, because our character, Rudy, is almost always quite literally in the middle of it. It's not always over there or back there or in a film's sake, up there. It's actually all around here. And if you have an opportunity to hear it in 5.1, you'll get even more.
I want to talk a little bit about the casting of this, because that is your real mom.
It's my real mom.
First off, when did you realize your mom was a good actor? This isn't the first time she's been in your videos and stuff, but she's amazing.
You guys are so well lit, and I'm not, and it's making me insecure. Give me a second. give me 2 seconds.
He's grabbing a light.
Yeah.
We're narrating this.
What's up?
Oh, look at the natural. See, he does it authentic. He doesn't do it in post.
Come on,
this
now.
Is authentic light on the set.
Even my video calls are practical, baby.
That's great.
Okay. But yeah, going back to your mom, when did you first put her in a video and realize, like, whoa, she nailed it? Because I think, like, Aziz Ansari did this on a show too, and his parents were unbelievable in that Netflix show that he did.
That's exactly right. It's hard to pull off. I was actually inspired by Martin Scorsese, who would do that frequently in his films. I mean, if you watch everything from Casino, Goodfellas, he even did a documentary on them. His mom makes a lot of cameos, and she's really just being her unapologetic, authentic self. And that was inspiring to me and very reminiscent of how my mom is. I discovered fairly early that my mom had this performative quality to her, and she wasn't shy, and she was able to be her incredible self, whether there's a camera crew there or not. And I knew that that was the only way to make this film. It was a non-starter for me. Considering any other actor would have been a non-starter. I knew that she had to play my mom, or I'd have to change up the story.
Did it make it harder or easier for you, do you think?
In some ways, both. Harder because it drives me nuts, but easier because you get a really honest performance. I mean, from a director's standpoint, it was tricky because my mom doesn't have the best short-term memory and has a hard time memorizing lines on a page. So what I realized fairly quickly while we were rehearsing is we have to ditch the script completely. And in a very Curb Your Enthusiasm style, I had to guide her to hit the beats and just have a normal conversation. So I told her the camera weren't rolling on a few takes. The cameras weren't rolling on a few takes, and they were. And we cross-shot everything so that we can lean into that improv. So for all this, all the moments with my mother, we almost always had three cameras, two overs and then one two-shot. And then I would just say, you know, in Portuguese, Mãe, vamos conversar um pouco. Mom, let's just have a conversation. And then I'd guide her through where I knew the beats were. And before you knew it, we had a take. I don't even know.
Speaking of Curb, you also.
Sorry. Oh, yeah, that's ahead, a great segue. But I don't even know. Sometimes I think about it. I'm like, I don't know if my mom realizes that it's a movie. I think she thinks like we're just like making a Vine or something.
Which is where you got your start, I think, right?
Where Vine. I got my start.
I used to churn out some Vines, man. You had like 6 seconds to make magic happen.
Yeah, it was so interesting to me. How do you tell a story in 6 seconds? I loved that challenge.
It was a cool app. It had a good run. It set the stage for where we're at now. Mm-hmm. But you mentioned Curb, JB Smoove as your kind of sidekick. I've been to a ton of comedy shows, and I saw his show. That was the hardest I've ever laughed in my life. I seriously thought I was gonna like throw up. I was laughing so hard. Curious what the dynamic was like on set and why you chose him.
Well, firstly, I'm a massive fan. This character could have gone in a few different directions, but someone who had that very natural comedic timing, and more than anything, the ability to improv, and who's more of a mastermind than somebody like JB. I'm a huge fan of Curb, huge fan of Leon's character, and I wanted to bring a bit of that to the Anwar character. Same deal. We cross-shot all of our moments so that we could improv. Every take was slightly different. And I've always dreamed of doing that with somebody as skilled as he is. So that was a dream. I mean, every take was slightly different than the last. And one thing I did notice with JB was when we had the note of no swearing, no curse words, no swearing, it fundamentally changed the rhythm of the scene and the level of the improv. Because what I realized then is it's like removing a word from your vocabulary. Not only a word from your vocabulary, but using a very word that you use so frequently from your vocabulary. It's like, can you improv without saying the word the? Now you have to start thinking about every sentence. Everything's got to be premeditated and careful. And I don't know that he had done that before in that way, because he was so used to Curb. So the character changed as these parameters were introduced. And that was really interesting to dance around with JB, because I also say the F word quite a bit and a bunch of swear words. And the note I kept getting from the studio was like, you know, Rudy, we're aiming for a PG-13. Can you chill out?
That's super interesting. And it must be challenging. I mean, yeah, every other word out of his mouth in Curb is an F-bomb.
Yeah, and it's so funny, and it's such a big part of personality.
It's hilarious. No, it's, yeah.
It's like asking Joe Pesci to not use a swear word. I guess he did in Home Alone. But it's like, it's just a different character. They're not the same person.
Yeah, I will say, we had a discussion on another podcast I do with the DP of Home Alone, and he said that they invented that fragile because of that. He needed to do something, and they, when he gets burned and gets hit with stuff, he does that invented language specifically so they could keep the rating.
I did not know that.
I'm curious about kind of the storyboarding, for lack of a better word, in this film. Because this is so autobiographical, there are these elements from your content creator life, the puppets, and this is one of those movies that I almost think is unspoilable. That said, we won't spoil any of the plot points because it's really so experiential that it's fun no matter what. So everyone who's listening to this should go check this out. But the puppet character, is
Diego,
comes from and it's interesting because in the film it kind of functions as the character's inner monologue and these discussions and kind of wrestling with ideas. And was this always planned to be part of the film? Is this kind of, it's almost surreal element of a puppet that you actually not only is kind of like the hobby of the main character, but also something that's very reflective?
Yeah, I mean, me creating this puppet series with these custom-made puppets and creating these little videos and shorts around the puppets is something I really did at a fairly young age. I just, you know, inspired by Avenue Q and Team America, but also like Family Guy and Simpsons. I love adult humor through humanized puppets. yep. I found that very funny. You know, Cranky Anchors and stuff. And I always wanted to start my own and really make sure that there are a diverse group of puppets, particularly this one kind of, you can call it my alter ego, Diego, who is based on, I want to say, a combination of people in my life that I grew up with, family, friends, people in the neighborhood. They were mostly Brazilian, Hispanic, Portuguese speaking, Spanish speaking. And so I created this puppet that kind of emulated some of the accents that I'd pick up on. And, you know, he's like, I think of Diego as like a puppet Larry David. He kind of just says whatever he's feeling, completely unfiltered. He's his unapologetic self. He's controversial and he doesn't care about anything or anyone. And I knew I wanted the puppets to be a part of the story because that's a part of my story, is this person having the fantasy of pursuing music, puppetry, comedy, creating, just really creating. In real life, I discovered Vine and started shooting videos and putting out music. And that's how I got my start. In the film, it's through a puppet, a theatrical puppet show. And then as we were writing, we realized, you know, it would be really interesting if Diego had a mind of his own. And he came to life beyond Rudy puppeteering.
Almost like the angel on your shoulder or the devil kind of a concept that, where it's like giving you advice.
That's right.
Pushing you in a direction.
That's exactly right. So almost accidentally, Diego, this puppet, became kind of an unreliable voice of reason. Not dissimilar to JB's character, Anwar. So the whole idea was like, we need to have a bunch of characters. I mean, I guess Diego represents Rudy's consciousness in a way, because every time he's doing something wrong, Diego points it out. But the whole idea was that, you know, Rudy's being pulled in all these different directions throughout the entire film. His mom pulling him in one direction, encouraging him to stay within the stay in the community and settle down within the culture, etc. Haley, who Rudy's dating at the top of the film, represents a very safe route that he can take. You know, finish college, have my father help you get a job in the city. Let's move in together in a conservative neighborhood. Whereas Isabella, Cammy's character, represents the antithesis of that, which is follow your gut, have an adventurous spirit. Not knowing is okay. Embrace your faults. And the question, you know, as I was writing, that we kept asking was, well, what does Rudy want? And I don't think he really knows until the very end of the film.
Wanted to bring up one other thing about some casting decisions, because I noticed something and it took me a minute until I saw the credits. But first off, I noticed you in The Flash last year, mm-hmm. as one of the roommates in the film. Mm-hmm. And I see Andy Muschietti playing guitar in the subway, the director of The Flash and It and a number of amazing films. What are you guys creating, like a South American cinematic universe? Like what is happening here? What's your guys' connection?
I met Andy a few years ago. We got really close during the pandemic. We had a pod together. He lives fairly close to where I live, and we're either at his house or my house, like every day. And we became super close. And now him and his sister Barbara and his whole family are like family to me. He asked just kind of nonchalantly one day, it's like, hey, do you want to be in The Flash? You want to do this little role, this cameo? I was like, all right. And I did it. And then that shot in London. And shortly after, I was starting production on Musica. And similarly, I asked him, like, do you want to do a small little bit in my movie? You have to play a homeless guy and you have to sing and play guitar. And he's like, hell yeah. So we kind of just agreed to be in each other's shit. He's like one of my favorite people, and we're very, very close. So I think he'll appear in everything I do, and hopefully vice versa. I'm actually shooting his I don't know if I'm allowed to talk about this. Actually, I'm shooting something of his.
He's gonna be like your Stan Lee, just like popping up and everything.
That's exactly right. Cameo, you gotta look for the Andy Muschietti cameo in every piece. Yeah, but I mean, I'm happy you caught that, because it's easy to miss if you don't look close.
I was like, he looks so familiar. Who is that? And my wife and I, even when we go to the theater, we sit through the entire credits and stay quiet as people rumble out of there. But we always listen to the music that's playing in the credits and then look for names. And I was like, oh, I knew it. I knew that was somebody. but I thought that was a nice little Easter egg in there. Matt, do you have any more questions about the film? Because I want to talk about your content creating.
Yeah, I mean, I want to talk one more question, because this is primarily a composer podcast. You are the director and writer and actor and, of course, composer. Was there ever any debate in your mind whether you should be composing the music for this, or was that a given? That's kind of part one. And part two is the way that the themes came together in this feel so organic, even to the point where, you know, there's kind of a emotional scene in the film where the theme for Isabella is then played by the character. And that kind of brings, you know, the score into something that's very diegetic and central to the scene itself, which almost seems to me, maybe I'm answering my own question, that's an idea that would have to come from a composer. So I really like how that came together. But I'm curious about your approach with the music, and whether you knew, whether this was a given, that you would be the one, you know, in charge of the music for this as well.
Yes, that was always the plan. To me, there was no version where I didn't direct and compose this. It's also something that's seldomly done. I'm glad to see Michael Giacchino is picking that up, because he's a filmmaker. He's passionate about filmmaking as much as he is music making. And I've always wanted to do that with my first film. Like, boy, wouldn't that be amazing if I could write, direct, and also compose the music for my first film, for all my films for that matter. There was never a hint of doubt about that. You know, they're very heavily intertwined in this film. Like as you mentioned, the diegetic and non-diegetic conventions kind of seem to blur a lot of times. And I mean, to me, we only scratch the surface of what's possible there. But if I'm going to tell a story from the perspective of somebody who's music crazed, I better be behind the music as well. So yeah, that was always the plan, and it was tricky at times, because, you know, I'm trying to memorize lines and cues and blocking and act. I don't consider myself really an actor, but I had to be believable as an actor. But my brain is thinking about, oh, that performer was off by a little bit, or oh, that choreography was wrong, and it's like it's hard to split between director mode and actor mode. But luckily, I was
playing
myself.
Yeah, it's a lot of hats to wear. Yep.
Yeah, but luckily I was playing myself. So, you know, if I had to be truly in character as an embody an entirely different human being, it would have been much harder.
I was trying to think of it when I was watching this, because there's like John Carpenter, who directs and scores, mm-hmm. and there's John Ottman, who edits and scores, mm-hmm. but I can't think of somebody who's directed, written, starred in, and scored a movie. Are you the first person to do that, or do you know?
No, I'm sure I'm not. Charlie Chaplin even,
that's a good
even point. Edited his own films and choreographed them. I mean, that's why I got him right here, by the way. There's not a ton of one human bands out there, as you just mentioned.
Yeah,
and
right.
and he was, but you know, another I don't know if you guys ever heard of a film called Cat in the Moon, by Alex Wolff. But check it out, because he's a fantastic actor, and is an indie film that he wrote, directed, scored, and is the lead of. So I can't say I'm the first, but certainly not the last.
Well, let's get into your content creation a little bit, because obviously what you do outside of the film Musica, I mean, everything set the table for what you did on this film and do it wearing all those hats, mm-hmm. your content creation. Some of these projects, like I said, people have probably seen at least one of them, but if not many. But these are, at this stage, these are really high level production value. It looks like there's budget to make these, but I'd love to just kind of maybe weave through the history of this, starting with Rudy making a Vine, now to, you know, making an 8-minute video for Only Murders in the Building that has an unbelievable production value. Like, how has your content creation process changed over the years as you've grown this following and I'm sure sponsorships and stuff like that? But let's start with the Vine. What inspired you to make videos initially?
At the time that Vine was born, I was pretty off the grid. I didn't have Instagram, or I didn't really use Instagram or Twitter. I didn't really understand the language of social media. And this was before social media videos were really a thing.
Mm-hmm.
You'd go to YouTube for videos, and you'd go to social media to either read tweets or see pictures.
Yeah, Instagram didn't even have video.
It did not.
For the first couple years.
No.
It was just like a put filters on your photo app.
That's right. And TikTok hadn't existed, or I guess it did, but it was called Musical.ly at the time. It had a very different purpose. So Vine came about and had this parameter of six seconds, a very tight time frame to tell a story, and then it would loop. And somebody told me about that when I was in college at Rutgers Newark, as you saw in the film. And somebody's like, I feel like you'd be good at this. You're a really creative person. You're like kind of out of your mind. The 6-second looping format was really attractive to me. Cause like, how on earth do you tell a story? If it's not that different from a film, you know, you have three acts. Think of it as like 2 seconds per act. So you got like your setup and then your body and then your payoff. And then it would loop, which is a really nice tool for comedy, for sound, for music. So I started doing these piano loops. That was the first thing, was the challenge of creating a perfect loop on Vine. You couldn't edit, you couldn't upload, you couldn't, it was what you see in camera is what you get. And then I started shooting some videos with my mom where, you know, we kind of satirized the stereotype of the Brazilian mother. And then I started creating some characters. I shot stuff with my friends. And over the course of like a month or two, I started amassing a following kind of overnight. And I didn't really know what it meant, but it did encourage me to just keep creating stuff, whether it be puppets, whether it be my mom, whether it be musicals. And then that's when the idea really, really came. It's like that this could potentially be,
it could be an avenue
for creating, but also getting to the goal, which is to make a film. So then everything between then and now has been expression, but also strategic, strategically piecing together all these ideas and auditioning certain ideas that I one day want to elevate in the film. And if you notice in the film, there's at least a dozen pieces, either sequences, scenes, or set pieces that are based on something I've already published on the internet.
Yeah.
Part of the biographical nature.
That's right.
I mean, you're showing the stuff.
Yeah, so when we did that,
was there a pivotal...
when we did that big one, for instance, where all the sets are interchanging and breaking down and assembling and dissembling, I did that in 2 music videos so that when I was challenged, like, you know, it's going to be impossible to get this in half a day, and it's going to be impossible to do it with the rhythm performers and the choreographer. I said, no, it isn't impossible. I've done it for 1/100th of this budget. So that was really good in justifying some of my more radical ideas.
It's a really interesting way to scale your skills. It's just kind of the progression of your channel into this feature film.
Yeah.
Yeah, it always helps. It always helps. You say, you know, I've already auditioned this creative, and it resonated with a bunch of people. It's harder for people to argue with that rather than, you know, because a lot of times filmmakers have brilliant ideas, but they only exist in their head. which is why they hire people to actualize them, hire people to storyboard it. They put sizzles together and pitch presentations, and they prep. A lot of the videos I'd made in my past became very useful during the prep for this movie.
Well, it's kind of like Kyle Mooney and Beck Bennett, the Good Neighbor group. Like, they did YouTube videos that were hilarious, mm-hmm. with really, you know, handy cams and no budget. And then they go to SNL and you see them remaking those exact sketches with a full production team and cinematic quality filmmaking. And it's like, I don't know. Sometimes the original was funnier because they had too many people in the kitchen trying to, you know, move them around a little bit. But it's cool that you're utilizing that as well. But you're also the director, so you can decide at the end of the day what happens. But I wanted to ask about, on that path, was there a particular video that you made that you think was like the moment where you went from Rudy, the guy who makes videos, to like a real player in this game? Because the amount of followers you have is insane.
There really wasn't. I think this industry and the world likes to put people in boxes. And I think for a while I was put in the content creator box, still am. But I never thought of it in that way, because like when I was making Vines, I guess I was a Viner. When I was making YouTube videos, I guess I was a YouTuber. But when I compose stuff for other people, I consider myself a composer. And when I did a live performance, when I opened up for Bieber during the Purpose Tour, I was a live performer. So I guess like I'm just a creator.
What are you, Rudy?
I guess I'm just a creator. I'm just a guy who likes to create stuff. So like for me, the goal was never I want to amass a following on the internet. That part wasn't strategic. That was accidental. I got lucky. People seemed to like the stuff that I was doing, so I capitalized on that, and it excited me, and my drive got more intense. But the only strategy for me was use all of this and leverage this momentum to be able to do what your real dream is, and it's to tell a 2-hour story, not a 6-second or 5-minute or 15-minute story. But it was kind of the best film school I ever went to. Was making content for the internet. But to answer your question, no, there wasn't one pivotal moment where I felt anything different. For me, it was all under the same kind of I'm creating stuff, bubble. I say making this film has felt like the biggest departure from everything else that I've done.
Gotcha. We have a lot of listeners who are in music school and aspiring composers and content creators. What advice do you give people in terms of, you know, the world we live in now? You have to be visible. You have to be posting. There's so much pressure for people to exist in this world, and you've masterfully accomplished that. What do you tell people when they ask you about how to survive in that space?
Yeah, I mean, it's the pressure is high, and it's anxiety inducing. I mean, when I started, there was a lot less saturation in this market and in this world. There are very few people making videos. Today, that's obviously changed. The content volume is so high. The market is so saturated. I can only speak from my experience, because had I decided to start creating today, I don't know that I would have survived in this Wild West. I don't understand social media anymore, to be quite honest. Like I don't have TikTok, and I feel the age and the generational gap finally has hit me. The advice that I would give to anybody who wants to do anything creative is just use this as a free tool, because your phone is an amazing tool and device to tell stories and share your perspective. Use it. You know, whether you get zero views and no likes, I consider like my Instagram page my resume. And I think people should start thinking of it in that way. It's not for everybody. Like, I know people who are completely off the grid and prefer it. I admire and support that. But for those who really want to find their footing, it could be a really useful tool. I mean, if you compose something and it's beautiful, share it. Put it everywhere. And if nobody sees it, share another one the next day, and then another, and then another. Keep learning. Watch movies. Listen to compositions. Create your own. And when you're ready, put it out there. Had I not put my ideas out there, I would have never been seen.
Yeah.
But it's overwhelming. Movie is it's overwhelming. I mean, you guys know.
It's constant.
I just want to encourage everyone. I know we've talked a lot about the technicals, but this movie is such a special thing, both in kind of its construction and also just in its kind of in the life that it has throughout it. Your work and perspective is very apparent watching this thing. It's fun. It's hilarious. So like, you accomplished all of these many things. And obviously, you know, every one of our listeners, I think this is such a cool way that a story came together, even with all of the kind of things that led up to it, and kind of the dress rehearsals of a lot of the concepts maybe that you had done and kind of perfected in the film. But man, did this come together so well. So I just want to say, really, this is a really, really cool film. Everyone needs to check out.
And I also really appreciate you guys taking the time to watch and to speak with me. I'm actually curious. I got a quick question for you guys. You both watched the film?
Yeah.
And did you watch it with headphones? No headphones?
I had to watch it on my laptop because the screener app didn't work on the Apple TV. So I think, Matt, you listened on headphones, right?
I got studio monitors right here. So I, okay. But it's just stereo.
Oh, shit.
So
check
I was
out
just getting
Matt.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Matt watched in stereo, baby. He's
right.
In the 90s now.
Matt watched it at an AMC theater somehow. I'm curious, what was there a part that resonated with you guys the most, and was there something that you didn't love or wish there was more of? I appreciate, you know, evaluation and criticism from like-minded individuals.
I mean, of course I would say I don't really have any faults with this. This is a really like a crowd pleaser movie. So, I don't think that there is it didn't really feel slow at any point. I'll say like the first scene that you mentioned really grabs your attention. Mm-hmm. And so you kind of know a little bit of the ride that you're in for, and this isn't going to be kind of like the, you know, kind of same heart-rent, like the romantic comedy formula, because this is like, in a lot of ways, there is a romantic comedy, but it's kind of a bigger comedy even than that. So I think this plays on a lot of levels that are super interesting. All of those individual musical pieces are very well spaced throughout the entire film. I don't have a single negative thing to say. I mean, maybe if you had another $100 million, you could have done even more cool stuff. That would be my criticism. Like, it's really good. I think this is going to do really well. I love the movie.
All right. Matt's full of shit. What about you, Kenny?
Yeah, Matt, we're going to X you off.
So. No, that was very kind. Thank you, Matt. Appreciate it.
No, I think the thing that I noticed the most, and this is coming from somebody who's been a camera operator for 20 years.
Oh, I didn't know that.
My day job is cinematographer and cameraman and all that stuff. And I couldn't stop paying attention to how stressful it must have been for you as a director who's also in front of the camera, and knowing the storyboarding of a lot of these transitions that you're doing. They have to be perfect to work in the edit. Mm-hmm. and you aren't watching them in a monitor, you're on camera. So I'm wondering the whole time I'm watching, like, how many times did you have to cut, run around, check the shot, run back around, do it again? Because there's a lot of these like single camera movements or long shots, or like when you fall in your bed and the camera moves with you and tilts like mm-hmm. that seemed really stressful to me as somebody who's like, you know, you need the perfect, and as an editor too, like that has to work. So I don't know, maybe you can answer that question. Was that difficult? Did you have to double check all of those shots while you're
did
still
any not
set,
work and you had to cheat them?
A lot of times I was running back and forth between monitor and then back on set, but it really came to the preparation. Like me and my DP Shane Hurlbut, we very meticulously planned every single shot, every light setup, every color temperature, and every camera move in transition, so much that it was on paper as a schematic, so that there was nothing left to chance. For that reason, there's only so many hours in the day, and the director is also in every fucking frame of the thing. So we had to prep the hell out of it. And yeah, a lot of things didn't go according to plan. We either had to do some cheats in the edit and use music actually as a great way to cover certain things up. But yeah, I mean, I wanted the camera work to feel as theatrical as the concept.
Yeah, I mean, this movie's set up to be a Broadway show, and I don't know if you have any thoughts of that, but like, it's already kind of done. You just need to make it a little more two-dimensional.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, the synesthetic perspective is really interesting, and what I'd like to see more in film and TV in general is us blending and disrupting the conventions of how music works in film. Like, I don't think there just needs to be sound design and dialogue and score, and they're all these separate entities. But what happens when you start blending them a bit? I remember when I saw Birdman, and you hear this unnerving drum solo in the score, and then the camera follows our subject outside, and you realize, oh, that's diegetic. That's a street performer. That's not underscore. Those are the kinds of things I'd like to see more of. Those sonic illusions are so interesting. That's what gets me excited.
And my negative is not enough Diego. Yes. I like every time he's on camera, the videos that you do, awkward puppets and all that, like that character needs his own show for sure. He's
well,
hilarious.
Perhaps there will be.
Oh,
take it easy. Take it easy. Oh. I didn't say anything.
If you stayed the whole interview, folks, you just heard what we've all been waiting for. Diego signed with
the Diego show.
Dude, in the test screenings, Diego tested higher than myself and almost every other character. I think I'm the character that tested the least. I had the lowest score of any character in a film, and I'm not mad at it.
Well, you got a great cast, including Diego. Great cast in this.
Yeah. Well, Rudy, thank you so much, man, for coming on and hitting us up a few years ago. We talked about trying to get you on in the past, and then I saw the trailer come out, and I'm like, this is cool. And the fact that we were able to check it out, thank you for setting that up with a screener, because it was definitely worth checking out for this conversation. But also, like, that movie's going to be a cult hit in my
opinion. Oh, man, yes. That's very nice of you to say. I especially hope...
for anyone music-minded, this thing is going to blow you away. Yep.
Yeah, I never quite know, you know, but I was born on the internet where I've been called every name under the sun. There's nothing they can say that'll offend me. So we'll see we'll see what happens. But I really appreciate you guys watching. I appreciate you doing this. And hopefully this isn't the last time we talk.
Absolutely not. We'll set it up, man.
Okay, hell yeah.
Thank you so much. Reminder to our listeners, you can follow us Instagram at Score Movie, X Score the Podcast, Facebook Score a Film Music Documentary. Rudy Mancuso, you already follow him. We don't need to plug that.
All of us. Yep.
And you can check out the movie Musica on
Please
Prime
do.
Video.
Can't
right
recommend.
Now.
Must see.
Rudy Mancuso, everybody. Thanks.
Thank
man.
You guys so much. I appreciate you.